Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. When Prime Minister Vladimir Spidla of the Czech Republic made a state visit to the United States in 2003, the European Union was considering a constitution. In spite of considerable opposition, the constitution's supporters succeeded in making sure that the document made no mention of Europe's Christian roots. In fact, they opposed even the mention of religion. At an informal dinner, I asked Prime Minister Spidla to explain this view, which he supported. "I have just returned from Athens," he told me. "It is there, and not in Rome, that Europe finds its true roots." Well, welcome to the Europe of the unknown God. That's the unknown God whose shrine St. Paul discovered in his tour of Athens that he recounts in Acts 17, verse 23. Now, in the years since, the EU has been perpetuating that argument, that anti-Christian, anti-religion argument, in countless ways on multiple fronts. Today it is a full-fledged war. If Prime Minister Spidla loves Athens so much, why didn't he know as Aristotle? Why ignore Aristotle's simple principle of cause and effect? After all, when Christendom is ripped from its Christian roots, what must come to pass? What is left? Cardinal Robert Sarah answered that question bluntly in a recent address in Poland. "Europe is now plunging into nihilism," he observed, "turning away from the flesh and blood realities of history and nature to embrace instead vapid, content-free abstractions. Europe, built on faith in Christ, cut off from its Christian roots, is now in a period of quiet apostasy," he added. Well, perhaps you've already heard about Poland's reaffirmation of the Catholic faith when over a million Poles went to the country's borders to pray the rosary on the Feast of Our Lady of Victory. There they begged Our Lady to keep Poland Catholic and free. Well, now Poland's neighbors have joined in the call to preserve Christianity. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has rejected the demands of the EU bureaucracy that all EU members allow unlimited immigration into their respective countries from Islamic countries. The diktat from Brussels, the EU's capital, is an attack on our sovereignty, says Orbán, and he should know. 2 years ago, he pointed to his country's unique history, and I'm quoting, "When it comes to living together with Muslim communities, we Hungarians are the only Europeans who have experience, because we had the possibility to go through that experience for 150 years, end quote. The new arrivals, said Orbán, have been raised in another religion and represent a radically different culture. Most of them are not Christians, but Muslims. This is an important question because Europe and European identity is rooted in Christianity. I think we have a right to decide that we do not want a large number of Muslim people in our community. In our country, we do not like the consequences of having a large number of Muslim communities that we see in other countries, and I do not see any reason for anyone else to force us to create ways of living together in Hungary that we do not want to see." End quote. Well, just what is Orbán referring to? Polish Minister Mariusz Błaszczak recently observed that the migration crisis is the most serious problem affecting Europe, and that the crisis was created by the irresponsible acting of some European leaders, and he's talking about the EU. And those leaders are rapidly losing the support of their people. Traditional establishment parties are losing all over Europe. Scotland, Catalonia, Italy's Northern League, Germany's Bavaria, the list is growing every day of people who want out. A week ago, over 95% of residents of Italy's Lombardy region voted in favor of greater autonomy for the region during a non-binding referendum, Lombardy President Roberto Maroni said. Meanwhile, Europe's left just keeps on drifting further left. The Republic of Ireland honors the murderous terrorist Che Guevara. Sweden is quickly becoming the rape capital of the world, since 90% of the assailants are identified as foreigners running in gangs. Sweden tries to placate them with a stamp featuring a mosque. In Germany, terrorist jihadis are so numerous that police assigned to monitoring them demand they take weekends off to have a rest. And last week, Italy's foreign minister said that migration seen in the Mediterranean is only the tip of the iceberg of an exodus that may wind up being of biblical proportions. End quote. Even the commercial world is catching on. Supermarket giant Lidl airbrushes a Christian cross from its practicing in order not to hurt the sensibility of non-Christian customers. End quote. Nestle follows suit with its Greek yogurt. Now, where voters have a choice, they'll speak. In Austria, two conservative parties will join in a government, a coalition government, for the first time in memory, leaving the socialists and the opposition and the Greens out of parliament altogether, and that's historic. In the Czech Republic, Andrej Babiš, known affectionately as the Czech Donald Trump, was elected prime minister last Sunday and immediately called for other European countries to join him in a coalition to stop illegal immigration into their countries. Every EU country allowing such immigration has suffered a staggering rise in sexual assaults, with Afghans apparently the most prominent aggressors. In fact, sadly, American soldiers stationed in Afghanistan over the years of that war have seen firsthand the rank perversion rampant among Afghan Pashtuns, but they were forbidden by the Pentagon to stop it or even to mention it in their reports. Unfortunately, the EU has responded not with firm and decisive programs to protect its people, but by telling journalists not to interview so-called extremists about the massive problems, nor to mention the ethnicity of apprehended criminals. Well, Great Britain has voted to leave the EU, but Intelligence Director General Andrew Parker there recently reported that the terrorist operations are already at a scale and pace we have not seen before. In fact, London is now a more dangerous place than New York City. Renowned Middle East expert Bernard Lewis is blunt. Muslims seem to be about to take over Europe, he tells the Jerusalem Post, and future prospects are grim. Will it be an Islamized Europe or a Europeanized Islam, he asks. That's the only question left. What does all this mean for America? Like the EU state-controlled media, U.S. opposition media are as silent on the mortal threat to Europe as they are regarding our own immigration crisis. Dr. Angelo Codavilla, our friend who has spent a lifetime studying intelligence and foreign policy, doesn't see the U.S. to be so far gone as Europe, but he does say that Europe's unsustainable socioeconomic model, bureaucratized economies, social welfare, and self-imposed demographic decline are a warning to the United States. Mass migration into Euro-American civilization, he writes, especially from people from the Muslim world who neither share in nor sympathize with that civilization, is accelerating the crisis. Confidence in the future is being replaced by the sense that living as before will be impossible. On October 1st, Pope Francis spoke to a group of migrants in Bologna, calling them the Warriors of Hope. Well, if they are warriors, against whom are they waging war? This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood abortion liberales Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our pro-life victory seminars and our pro-life strategy guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills, to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. Japanese government says shrinking population is the biggest challenge for economic growth. And as the effects of population decline are being felt, Toyota forced to cut auto lineup. Jonathan Abamonte reports. For decades, population growth in Japan has been below replacement levels. Demographers have long warned that the country's low birth rate combined with low immigration are unsustainable. In recent years, the population has now begun to shrink, and the country's demographic decline has become a considerable obstacle to economic growth. Many Japanese have now come to realize the seriousness of the situation. Following a decisive election victory for his party over the weekend, Japan Prime Minister Shinzo Abe promised to tackle population shrinkage and aging as one of the two main objectives of his new government. The election was about chiefly the North Korean threat and also about the declining birth rate, Abe said in a press conference. If we don't do something now, it will be too late. Abe called the demographic decline the biggest challenge for economic growth going forward. The problem is progressing by the minute, and we cannot afford waiting around, he said, according to UPI. As a case in point, auto manufacturing giant Toyota Motor Corporation also recently announced that it is planning to cut in half the number of car models it sells in Japan by 2025, according to Reuters. Automobile companies have struggled to maintain sales in Japan in the context of a shrinking market. According to data tracked by the Japan Automobile Manufacturers Association, JAMA, over 32.3 million passenger vehicles were sold in Japan from 1995 through 1999. But by 2010 through 2014, auto sales had plummeted by nearly a third to only 24.5 million vehicles. Auto sales in Japan have declined in part due to population aging, a byproduct of several decades of sub-replacement fertility. The younger generation has also shown less interest in owning personal vehicles, partly a symptom of increasing urbanization and the emptying out of many rural areas. Toyota now plans to cut the number of models it will sell in Japan from 62 in its current lineup down to 30 models in the coming years, according to Reuters. The automaker has signaled that it will pursue a number of strategies in an effort to maintain sales of at least 1.5 million vehicles a year. According to JAMA, Toyota is Japan's largest automaker in terms of the number of new and used passenger vehicles sold annually in the East Asian nation. The impending weakening of the auto industry is yet another symptom of the country's long road to demographic decline. According to estimates from the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, UNDESA, Population Division, total fertility in Japan has been below replacement since at least the late 1970s. There are simply not enough babies being born for the next generation to replace the current one. Following decades of below replacement fertility, the population is now shrinking. While fertility rates have rebounded slightly over the past decade, the most recent estimates show that the total fertility rate, TFR, in 2014 sat at an anemic 1.42, according to the Statistic Bureau of Japan, far below the estimated replacement fertility rate, which sits at 2.07. That same year saw the number of live births slipping to just over 1 million, the lowest number of births ever recorded for the land of the rising sun. According to population estimates from the Statistics Bureau of Japan, the country's total population peaked in 2008. It has been declining every year since 2010, and by 2016, Japan had lost over 1.1 million people. Excluding migration, the population of Japan last year declined by 295,865 persons, roughly the equivalent of the population of Cincinnati, Ohio. Even after accounting for net gains from immigration, however, the total population still shrank by over 160,000 people. The Statistic Bureau of Japan pegs the current population at 126 million, but steep declines are expected over the next few decades. According to a report of the Japanese Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare, as cited by the BBC, the government estimates the population will decline to 87 million by 2060. By that time, the ministry estimates 40% of the population will be of retirement age. UNDESA Population Division figures project that Japan's population will decrease to 103 million by 2060, a less precipitous but still alarming decline. Japan's demographic decline is expected to bring significant challenges for the island nation in the years to come. The Japanese have the highest life expectancy in the world. With old age dependency set to rise, proportionally fewer working age adults will be around to care for them or to pay into social support systems. As Toyota's plans suggest, Japan's population decline will continue to hamper future economic growth. Japan is currently the world's third largest economy after the United States and China, according to the World Economic Forum, a status the East Asian nation is unlikely to keep for very long if the population decline continues. It remains uncertain to what extent Japan's demographic decline will impact economic growth. But without a reversal of the current population trends, it can be expected that Japan's economic, military, and geopolitical influence, and consequently also those of its principal allies and trading partners, will likely suffer. That's the weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. We'll be right back. By now, we all know that Planned Parenthood is accused in the United States of allegedly violating the law by, among other atrocities, selling baby body parts. But what you might not realize is that Planned Parenthood's affiliates, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, and International Planned Parenthood Federation, IPPF, are still getting away with murder overseas. Around the world, and especially in Latin America, the baby-killing giant shades the truth about its abortion-related activities. It runs roughshod over local anti-abortion laws and violates local pro-life sentiment, all with seeming impunity. But not anymore. With your tax-deductible gift, PRI will throw the book at the abortion giants overseas, just as pro-life groups are doing here at home. Did you know that PPFA spends about $38 million a year lobbying to legalize abortion in countries around the world? If they're successful, they can kill as many, if not more, babies overseas as they do in the United States. But there's a hitch. Because abortion remains illegal in most Latin American countries, neither IPPF nor PPFA is eligible for government funding for abortion-related activities as they are in the United States. So PPFA, IPPF, gets around it as only they know how to do, by lying. With a wink and a nod, they disguise the programs they are funding as, quote, education or health programs, women's right, human rights protection or promotion, and anti-discrimination initiatives aimed at protecting vulnerable groups such as women or LGBTs, that means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, end quote. Catholic bishops throughout Africa and Latin America complain about this. They call it ideological imperialism, but their voices are not heard in Congress because America's bishops depend on billions in government funding for their own charities. They don't want to bite the political hand that feeds them. Now, PRI receives no government funding, so we aren't hampered by golden handcuffs. That's why your tax-deductible gift to PRI is so important today. As the lead group investigating Planned Parenthood's activities overseas, PRI's Latin American office has uncovered PPFA's thinly disguised efforts to undermine pro-life laws and legitimate abortion on demand. But we've only found the tip of the iceberg, and there is more work to be done, work that we can't do alone. Your tax-deductible gift will help PRI hire a seasoned pro-life legal team to help us expose, investigate, and prosecute Planned Parenthood's affiliates everywhere they prey on women, especially overseas. Together, we'll expose, investigate, and prosecute PPFA and IPPF everywhere it tries to hide the truth. This two-prong attack, complementing the hearings taking place in Washington, will force Planned Parenthood to fight on two fronts. What better way to strike a blow against the real Planned Parenthood, the one we saw in all those horrific videos, than to come at them here and abroad? So please make a tax-deductible gift to support this and all of PRI's baby-saving efforts around the world. Yes, they're powerful. Yes, they're big. But remember, David and Goliath. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. Since the election of Donald Trump, officials at the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops have commended the president's actions on six specific issues: religious liberty, the HHS contraceptive mandate, United Nations abortion funding, Planned Parenthood funding, the Mexico City policy regarding U.S. funding of international abortions, and transgender student regulations. Now, since last November, USCCB officials have also attacked the president's positions on over a dozen key issues, including health care, the travel ban, refugee policy, Cuba policy, the Paris Agreement, the death penalty, global warming, the environment, migration, immigration, foreign aid, sanctuary cities, deportations, and border security. Now, in both cases, our bishops have done this formally and publicly, citing the authority of Catholic social teaching and their authority as bishops. What you might notice, and what the bishops don't mention, is this. While all those Trump positions commended by the bishops address magisterial issues involving objective goods and objective evils, all of the Trump policies they oppose entail what the Church calls prudential issues. What's the difference? Lumen Gentium, the dogmatic constitution of the Church adopted at the Second Vatican Council, explains the difference between the two categories. First, in Lumen Gentium number 12, we learn that, from the bishops down to the last of the lay faithful, they, the faithful, show universal agreement in matters of faith and morals, end quote. So, in magisterial matters regarding religious liberty, marriage and the family, and inalterable truths expressed in Humanae Vitae, our bishops and the faithful alike are, and I quote, bound to adhere to the teaching of the Church in matters of faith and morals. And therefore, we are bound to commend the president's policies that involve issues in the first category, objective evils, objective goods, since every one of them either inhibits an objective evil, like abortion or contraception, or defends an objective good, the nature and dignity of the person, religious liberty, and so on. Now, in number 37, Lumen Gentium addresses the second category, in which the bishops condemn a variety of specific prudential Trump initiatives. Regarding this category, the Church teaches us two vital principles. First, these initiatives involve policy particulars on which good Catholics and good people generally have not only the right but the duty to exercise the authority bestowed upon us by God to act prudentially and faithfully in the social and political realm. We can even, in good faith, disagree on specifics, since many paths are often available to serve the common good. Second, advocating particular approaches to such prudential issues is not the province of the clergy and the hierarchy, but precisely of the laity. And I quote from Lumen Gentium, "by reason of the knowledge, competence, or preeminence which they have," period, end quote. And by the way, Lumen Gentium was written by bishops. So they were acknowledging here the fact that they do not have power in certain realms or authority. It isn't the laity who are limiting the bishops here. It's the bishops telling the truth about the limits of their own authority, and that's key. So when it comes to the positions of President Trump, when it comes to moral magisterial issues that Catholics are bound to support, the bishops support him. However, on every issue on which Catholics can disagree, our bishops oppose the president, usually supporting instead the agenda of Barack Obama. Now, it's clear that the hierarchy is often tempted to stray into the realm reserved to the laity. Over the course of history, it's true. And in fact, that temptation has proven so strong over the centuries that it has been repeatedly condemned by the Church, by bishops and popes, including Pope Francis, by its proper name, clericalism. Today, the errors spawned by clericalism are widespread in the American Church, and their spread has a history. In the late 1970s, Mark Gallagher, the chief pro-life lobbyist at the Bishops' Conference, urged the bishops to defend the Church's magisterial teaching, which at the time was under ferocious assault after Roe v. Wade. Gallagher urged bishops specifically to, and I quote, "educate and correctly form the consciences of American Catholics about the primacy of the sanctity of life and the pursuit of the common good." Specifically, he urged the bishops to make clear that those candidates who refuse to support the common good would be morally unacceptable for public office. However, Gallagher reports in Crisis magazine, the USCCB's much larger social justice staff disagreed. After all, their goals and prudential judgments were more reflected by the Democrats in Congress, end quote, says Mr. Gallagher, the U.S. Catholic Conference's former pro-life lobbyist. Now, the battle lines were drawn. 40 years ago, a majority of pro-life Catholics were Democrats. The conference's social justice staffers feared that if the bishops put the pro-life issue in its proper and preeminent place, many pro-life Democrats would become Republicans, given the radical pro-abortion stance quickly spreading among the Democrat office holders at the time. The social justice advocates feared that, and I quote from Gallagher, this shift in the Catholic vote would necessarily hurt their legislative agenda, end quote. Now that is the welfare state agenda, which Catholics may endorse and embrace, but are not required to. And reducing support for welfare state programs in Congress would be the inevitable result of people becoming more pro-life. So these staffers convinced the bishops to, and I quote, undertake a campaign to convince Catholics that there was a justification to vote for pro-abortion candidates, end quote. Well, there you have it. That is authoritative, first-hand, eyewitness testimony. At the headquarters of America's bishops, the sanctity of life was sacrificed on the altar of social justice. But that altar was also strewn with other idols. After all, the bishops did not want to embarrass prominent pro-abortion Catholics, their buddies like Ted Kennedy, Joe Biden, Mario Cuomo, and other Democrats whose support was critical to continue the generous federal funding that was directed to the bishops' own welfare agencies by the tens and hundreds of millions a year. The result? Welcome, my friends, to the seamless garment. The bishops have continued on their failed course for 40 years with fateful, disastrous results, Gallagher laments. Indeed, the U.S. Catholic Conference social justice staffers have convinced two generations of bishops to act as though their welfare state of general is as magisterial as the sanctity of life, that the increasingly radical and pro-abortion platform of the Democrat Party is as binding on Catholics as Humanae Vitae. This profoundly defective and destructive view abides to this day, as witnessed by a simple question which over a dozen major leading bishops have refused to answer when asked about their advocacy of their partisan agendas. Your Excellency, and I'm using here the language of canon law, am I bound to adhere to your political opinion with the same religious submission of mine with which I am required to adhere to the teaching of Humanae Vitae? Or is the view you express merely your personal opinion with which the laity have not only the right, but often the duty to disagree? Lumen Gentium, number 37. No bishop will answer. And the bishop's silence goes beyond their refusal to answer simple questions. Unfortunately, most are also silent about the truths so beautifully illuminated in Humanae Vitae, the encyclical of Blessed Paul VI, promulgated 49 years ago. Indeed, any honest review of the bishop's advocacy in recent years will reveal that, as their political partisan advocacy has increased, their teaching of magisterial truths has decreased in inverse proportion. As USCCB President Timothy Cardinal Dolan admitted in 2012 to the Wall Street Journal, most bishops had laryngitis on Humanae Vitae, and they have had it for 50 years. And the silence has spread. Many of the most vocal anti-Trump bishops are represented in Congress or the Senate by pro-abortion Catholic elected officials. We have contacted staff in the offices of Catholic politicians with 100% National Abortion Rights Action League ratings in Newark, New Jersey, Brownsville and El Paso, Texas, Stockton and Los Angeles, California, Richmond, Virginia. Not one can find any record of their bishop having publicly condemned their boss's pro-abortion position by name, the way their bishops have attacked the policies of Donald Trump. Why the silence? At the convocation held in Orlando earlier this year, USCCB President Daniel Cardinal DiNardo of Houston unconsciously confirmed his conference's failure to teach Lumen Gentium's fundamental truths. Way back when, he tells an interviewer, I was chair, he means chairman, of the pro-life committee. Conference staffers were trying to figure out how we can deal within the church with points of view that really should be complementary, but sometimes are in tension. The pro-life and the social justice people, for instance, end quote. There you go. For the president of the U.S. Catholic Conference, social justice, the welfare state agenda, and the sanctity of life are just two points of view. Obama's welfare state agenda and Humanae Vitae should have the same authoritative Catholic status with our bishops imprimatur. Well, pro-lifers apparently just haven't yet gotten the bishop's message after 40 years. that the Democrat Party welfare state platform really ought to be complementary with their defense of life. Humani Vitae's 50th birthday is coming next July 25th. Is your diocese going to celebrate it? This has been the PRI Review from pop.org. Thanks.